From Washington, D.C., the belly of the anti-marijuana beast. Season's greetings from normal staff and the board of directors to you and yours. This is Alan St. Pierre, executive director of Normal and the Normal Foundation. And I sincerely hope your holidays are both safe and hemp-filled.
Hi, this is Normal founder and legal counsel Keith Strop, wishing you a happy holiday from Normal. Let's use this time with family and friends to rededicate ourselves to ending marijuana prohibition and stopping the arrest of responsible marijuana smokers. Happy holidays.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back here to the Audio Stash today. It's Wednesday, December 26th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. I hope everyone is having a wonderful holiday week out there this week. Take a moment and help us end marijuana prohibition in America. You can make a big difference right now by taking a moment to visit norml.org, normal.org, to make your donation or join Normal today. A big, huge thank you to those of you out there who have supported Normal in 2007, looking forward to a big year in 2008. Got some best of shows for you this week here on the Audio Stash. We'll start today with our Cannabis Science Best of Show. We've got some great segments from 2007 with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. He joins us each Wednesday here on the program. And Mitch is just a wealth of information. We talk about the latest medical and scientific news. We talk about papers that he has published, he and his team. And we also get a chance to talk with Mitch, well, kind of about life, the universe, and everything. He really helps us out here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. So it's great to showcase some of the segments from 2007. Next week, we'll be back with a set of brand new episodes. It will be 2007 Marijuana, the year in review. It was a big year in 2007, and it is shaping up to be a huge year for marijuana reform in 2008. And we'll be covering it all right here on your stash, Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Also going to have some cool giveaways next week. We've got lots of cool stuff to give away to say thank you, sort of happy free stuff giveaways for the holidays here on the Audio Stash next week. So stay tuned. Let's get into our Cannabis Science Best of today. An hour-long episode featuring our interviews with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. First up today in our Cannabis Science Best Of, we go back to January of 2007, almost a year ago, January 17th. Mitch and I are talking about student drug testing. This is a very hot topic for Normal, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, among other groups out there who are working in various areas on student drug testing. Normal's senior policy analyst Paul Armentano has also testified about drug testing this year and DUI. And Mitch and I talk about it in January of this year. It's always great to have you on the program, Mitch. This week we're focusing in on student drug testing. So let's talk about the drug testing process from a psychological standpoint here. What is this situation like for a teenager to give over their bodily fluids to an authority figure administering the test?
Chris, as you can imagine, this is a time in life when not everybody's exactly at their peak self-esteem about their bodies in the first place. And then depending on the setting, the way these things are done, particularly in athletics, for example, with college students, you have to literally stand there naked so a person can see urine going into the cup so you're not substituting urine or something along those lines. And the nervousness associated with that would make anybody have a difficult time even being able to get their urine flowing. So it's just an outrageously invasive and curious thing for what's really turning out to be not much utility at all. We're not getting a lot of evidence that making people take urine screens is decreasing their drug use at all. And these tests don't really do particularly well with some of the more difficult drugs and some of the more debilitating ones.
Now, that's just very shocking to me, Mitch, and I hope people are familiar with this practice of having someone stand there and watch the students urinate into a cup. It just seems like the ultimate humiliation. You know, can this type of thing build up a certain level of submission to authority, do you think?
It's a scary thought when you start thinking about how the roles can take on their own form. And if you know the Stanley Milgram experiment or situations where people are put in command of other people and get to tell them what to do, people take on those roles pretty readily. I think this is also a particularly nerve-wracking thing for anyone who knows about the potential inaccuracies of these kinds of tests. So lots and lots of drug labs claim, oh, we've got a 95% rate or a 99% rate of perfect responses. But when you look at independent studies of lab accuracy, sometimes the false positives can be as high as 66%. That means over half of the people who are stated to be positive for drugs actually aren't. The tests that then they should perform are actually more expensive to confirm that these positives are true positives, but a lot of employers and a lot of schools don't have the money or don't have the inclination to do these subsequent tests, and people end up getting accused of drug use basically because of a false positive test or because of some kind of cross-reactivity with contact or Sudafed or diet pills or decongestants or some heart medication. And so as soon as you know that, of course, then you approach the test with even more fear and more disappointment. The other thing that really drives me nuts is marijuana, of course, stays in the system a really long time and is very difficult to get out of the system and easy to detect even when there's no intoxication on the job or at school. In contrast, the hallucinogens, alcohol, other drugs that can really have a harsh impact on job performance or on school performance are not as easy to detect. I've had students basically say, hey, I'm on probation. I'm subject to random urinalysis, so I can't smoke marijuana anymore, so I'll do a quarter hit of acid. I'm flabbergasted by this kind of thing, and yet that's what we're paying for time and time again.
You know, even on the Discovery Channel, last year I saw a program, and eating just a few poppy seed bagels caused a positive drug test for opiates. So it seems there are some things we could commonly come into contact with out there that could give a false positive in a drug test as well.
Oh, it's a frightening thought. And then when you think about, well, why are we doing this in the first place? If it's to detect people who are going to be impaired at work, why not give them a little neuropsych test or some kind of computer type video game and see, you know, is their performance actually impaired? Isn't that what really matters? My student Sarah Smucker Barnwell has a chapter on this in Pot Politics, my edited book that we talk about a lot. And she points out that, you know, even for air traffic controllers or neurosurgeons or things along those lines, if we had just a little task for them to do before they went in, some kind of computerized task or some kind of block sorting thing to show, hey, I'm not intoxicated by anything, that would be much better than, oh, here's your analysis that suggests you did this drug 2 weeks ago.
And when we talk about students, especially those in high school, do you think that these random drug tests are deterring kids from participating fully in their school environment. You know, not because they're regular users of marijuana or anything else, but they don't want to feel the pressure associated with these tests.
This is something that just sends the steam flying right out my ears, Chris. Who are the kids who are most buffered against drug problems, even if they do experiment with them? They're the ones who are engaged at school and engaged in extracurriculars. A number of schools have, you know, given random drug tests, and they particularly target folks who want to do the extracurriculars. This is the thing that's going to keep people from developing drug problems, and we're saying you can't do this if you're experimenting with drugs. That, I mean, it's so counterproductive, I'm just completely flabbergasted. When you look at the big Michigan studies on comparing schools that do drug testing to schools that don't, you find there's no impact on drug use anyway. So schools are spending, you know, $8 to $15 per student to basically get their urine, and it's having no impact on how much the students are doing drugs.
And further, Mitch, you mentioned before that there are other kinds of tests we could administer, the ones cognitive tests for workers to prove they're not currently intoxicated. But again, the drug tests that we already give could detect if someone experimented with marijuana 2 months ago. Do we need to take a broader attitude shift here and not condemn individuals who may have experimented with substances at some point in their lives?
In fact, it's normative. In fact, almost a majority of people experiment with drugs in the United States at some time in their lives. So this isn't some kind of rare sign of pathology. This is a sign of, you know, basically being a normal person who happened to get an opportunity to experiment. And then the irony is, we keep saying, oh, this is going to help productivity, this is going to help our work. When you look at the business data, the places that drug test either don't have any difference in their productivity or actually have a lower productivity because they're taking all this time out to go take somebody out to make them pee in a cup. There are a number of computer program places in California that basically have said this is not worth it. First of all, we're not getting the best applicants. People come in with their hair shaved because they know they don't want to take the hair test. And what's important is getting the job done, not what you're doing on your time off. Why not focus on job performance instead of some crazy metabolite in your pee?
And what I'm hearing today from you, Mitch, is that drug testing as we perform it right now is having serious psychological implications to the lives of millions of workers and especially students who must undergo the process. Also, I have to ask, when psychologists encounter someone who's experimented with illicit substances at some point, that isn't really viewed as deviant behavior anymore, is it?
It's really not anymore, and in fact, the idea that you haven't ever tried a drug by the time you reach, you know, age 40 is, in many ways, putting you in kind of a minority. I'm, you know, happy to see people go through their lives in ways that are consistent with their values, but that's not a big deal. The other thing that kind of drives me nuts is I'll get an email at least once a month basically saying, hey, I really wanted to work at Blockbuster, or I really wanted to work at, you know, the corner video store, and I had to take a drug test and I didn't pass, and so they threw me out. And I'm thinking, what on earth, would you accidentally put Titanic in with the comedies? It's just, what is the big problem that would have happened if you were a recreational drug user outside of work and you came to work and did your job? It just doesn't make any sense. It's really a poor use of resources. And it's developing this crazy underground market in how to pass drug tests, so that it's almost like these two sets of companies are in cahoots. We'll develop a drug test, and then we'll develop a way to get around it, and they can each sell products to different people and sort of run people against this war against each other and make a whole lot of money. It's wild.
Mitch, you mentioned the adulterants out there to try and foil the drug test, but can any of those products alone cause you harm in and of themselves?
We don't have enough data to be sure. It looks like the shampoos for the hair tests are pretty safe regardless. Some of the, you know, instant drinks and things like that, we just don't have any data at all. The idea that you should drink a lot of water and take Golden Seal and drink vinegar, I mean, all these crazy urban legends that have developed over the years, we just don't know. It's kind of crazy.
One method I heard employed out there is a very small amount of bleach, if you can imagine ingesting bleach, but that a very small amount of that in water is something people do use. Can that be dangerous even in small amounts?
Bleach is not for human consumption, period. It's poisonous. Yeah. I hear a lot of cranberry juice stories and people say it worked. I mean, I think if you drink a whole lot of liquid, of course, that's going to dilute your urine. There are tests now for if you've tried to delete your urine too much. They test the creatine. Now people take creatine supplements to try to make up for it. I mean, it's turned into this crazy cat and mouse circling game that is just a complete waste of effort on both sides.
Now, we've talked about the psychology of students when they undergo these drug tests, having someone stand there and observe them urinating into a cup. But what about the psychology going on with the parents here? That's important to touch on as well. There is just this tremendous amount of fear on the part of parents that their own child or other kids at school will be exposed to illicit substances. So how do parents break out of this fear and work proactively to solve these problems rather than demand whole student populations be drug tested?
The key to having an impact on your child's drug use is to have a meaningful relationship with your child. If they want to sit down and have a chat about drugs and make sure that there's an empathic, genuine interaction there and that they do things that are good recreational activities, that are, you know, skill-based leisure that they can train their children to do as well, they shouldn't really have to worry about any of this. Now, there's always going to be a subset of kids who develop drug problems. It's not necessarily anyone's fault. It's just an opportunity to intervene when they start showing signs of the problem. Not, oh, I'm going to detect it early in their urine, because it just breaks away the whole sense of trust that's essential to a good relationship. Let's chat. Let's talk. Let's make sure this happens before we get to the stage of, oh, I want to look in your eyes when you come back from the party and all that kind of crazy stuff. It's really an opportunity to lay a foundation early and make these things happen, not about lining everybody up and getting urine.
One of the things drug warriors recommend is that parents do regular searches of their teenagers' bedrooms for drugs and alcohol. But what about that technique specifically, Mitch? What kind of impact could that have on a family, especially if the parent is never finding anything at all?
We don't have a ton of data. I do have at least 5 case studies, so to speak, on that. And what I often get at the time is students are really infuriated and are upset about the violation of privacy, and understandably so. Yet when the parents find hard drugs, particularly amphetamine and meth were two that were in the folks I know, they are understandably infuriated and freaked out and all of that. But I said, well, did you ever ask them? Did you ever ask them about their drug use before you did this search? And they say no. So, I mean, clearly the asking them first idea is worth entertaining before we just start sneaking in with the guard
dog. Mitch, I want to conclude here today with this question. If a parent of a teenager really feels that someone has come away from a drug test somewhat psychologically compromised, should they seek counseling?
I'm optimistic that any good school psychologist would be happy to talk to them about this. But it would not be a big disappointment to me if vast numbers of students all stood up and said, we refuse to do this, and if you're going to kick us off the football team, that's fine. We're not willing to submit our bodily fluids in order to get extracurriculars at our educational institution. And I think as more and more students do this, the first few are really going to get in a lot of trouble, and then after a while, if we all stand together, so to speak, maybe we can put an end to this ridiculous waste of money and time.
This is one of the many segments you've heard here on the Audio Stash about student drug testing and drug testing in general. That was on January 17th, 2007 with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Next up in our Cannabis Science Best of Today, we are going to June 13th, 2007. And we don't just talk about the latest news and what's going on out there. Mitch also gives us the opportunity to talk about the psychology of different things. And in this segment, we talk about the power of persuasion. Here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash, we encourage everyone to get involved and do your part. And segments like this really help activists hone our skill. That's what's so great about having Mitch here each Wednesday. This segment from June of 2007. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Always great to speak with you, Mitch. This week we're going to talk about the power of persuasion. All of us are working very hard to make the case for marijuana legalization. We spoke with Matt Simon earlier this week from sendtherightmessage.com about bringing up the issue with presidential candidates in New Hampshire. So, Mitch, what's the best way to speak about a controversial issue and get people engaged in the issue?
As it turns out, what'll get folks to actually change their mind and what will actually get them to talk about it in the first place is sometimes two different things. What I'm discovering based on some social psychology research is that this notion of social proof, that other people are talking about it, will get people to talk about it. If you make some kind of reference to somebody who's an authority, that seems to help people get persuaded or at least get willing to talk about it. If you are a likable person, if you're a person who behaves in a likable way, people are more persuaded and more willing to talk about it. And if they think something is scarce, if they think, hey, there isn't a lot of this left, we really got to work this out right now, then they're also very willing to engage under those circumstances.
Mitch, many activists will use a lot of data and statistics. Are the numbers alone effective?
As it turns out, it depends on how the person initially is oriented to the topic. So people who are very well educated on a topic, they like to hear both sides and they love to hear the stats. If they really only know one position and they've already kind of made up their minds in a sort of emotional way, the stats are sometimes a waste of your effort. And so in some ways, what I recommend is ask folks an initial question to sort of get a feel for where they are, and then you sort of know what tack to take. Should I go with the latest data from the drug use surveys, or should I talk about some kind of moral argument or how it all feels?
Now, when somebody already has a deeply held belief, is it psychologically difficult to get someone to change their mind?
It is difficult if you present your argument and say that you're trying to persuade them. Where it gets easier is if you start asking questions instead. And in fact, this comes from the literature on how we get folks to stop using drugs problematically. Rather than saying, hey, you need to pay attention to the prohibition issue because it's really important, you say, hey, tell me what you think about, oh, the morality of putting people in jail for certain crimes. And now I start out with a very broad, big issue, something that people would love to talk about, and then as I gradually narrow in on, well, gee, what do you think about, oh, somebody going to jail for owning a plant? You know, you see how it sort of refines, and you're always asking questions rather than telling them things. People love to talk more than they love to listen, but as they're giving you their response to these things, you'll get the clues for, is this somebody who I can hook up to the audio stash? Is this somebody who I can point towards Normal and get them to join? Or is this somebody who I just need to educate with a book or with, you know, a simple article or something like that to get them on the path towards entertaining ideas about repealing drug prohibition?
And do these same techniques that work when we're on one-on-ones with individuals, do they work the same for a large group or a mass audience?
The problem with a mass audience is you can't tell where any one person is. So generally, you try to fire a whole lot of different approaches. You try to go at it a whole bunch of different ways. So if you're at an audience who's sort of on your side anyway, it's fun to give them both sides of the argument and talk about how to get there. But if you've got folks who are really opposing you and you really need to convince them, it's better to entertain them with opening up the questions. Let's go ahead and have the questions. Now, if you're a presidential candidate, you're not allowed to have questions. You're only allowed to have answers. So you point out how you're a reasonable person, how you're willing to entertain changing your mind, which is something that's an intriguing thing to actually lay out now, and that you've already got some strong feelings about it, and here they are. And it's funny how when you watch these guys, they're really good at getting the emotion out there, and that seems to be what crowds play to. That's what they seem to enjoy.
So having passion and emotion in the argument, that's just as, if not more important than the hard data that's on our side here.
As it turns out, nobody's ever really changed their mind because of statistics. Nobody really changes their minds for reasons so much as the emotions that those create. The problem has become we're so caught up in the emotions that those create, we think the emotions are all that you need. Usually emotions sway us because they're based on something factual, because they're based on something that's actually in reality, and we've cut out that step, and that's been a problem. But if I'm stuck in a, you know, I've got a 90-second elevator ride, and I want to persuade somebody to, you know, entertain medical marijuana laws, I'm going to go for the emotional thing just because I feel like that's the thing that's going to be the thing that they'll remember.
And does that emotion, does that passion work both ways? I mean, does the person you're speaking with respond in kind with their own emotions.
In fact, they do, and there's an opportunity to either take that and run with it if it's going in the direction you want when you're the persuader, or to move away from negative emotion by going back to the drier stuff. Let's move back to the statistics. Let's move back to the less personal things and get this negative feeling down in hopes that I can then switch it over. Some new data by my friend George Beiser suggests that people are much more strong about their opinions about what they oppose than what they are about what they support. Right. And so I end up doing things like, well, you know, don't you oppose racism? Don't you oppose unfair laws? Don't you oppose things that'll get drugs into the hands of teens? And then they're really fired up about these things that they really hate. And once they've got that strong opposing attitude going, then we can start pointing out how marijuana laws as they currently are actually create these things that those folks oppose.
And in your own experience, Mitch, not to put you on the spot here, but what's worked for you?
What's funny is I went around writing Understanding Marijuana with the idea, hey, everybody needs to learn that marijuana is harmless. That's one that they won't entertain. Instead, I'm having much better approach with the idea that it's immoral to throw people in jail for crimes that don't cause any harm. Right? And I start walking through about the idea that, hey, murder, that's something that's really terrible. We definitely want to have a big penalty for that. But, you know, double parking, that's not a big deal. We want to have not much of a penalty for that. Mm-hmm. Well, where does owning a plant fit on this scale? And suddenly, people are much more willing to entertain that. But if I do the, hey, marijuana is harmless thing, I'm often rebuked so badly that I can't ever get to the idea of we need to change the laws because they're just unfair.
Dr. Mitch Earlywine, in June of 2007, the Power of Persuasion segment there. We're going to keep going in our Cannabis Science Archives. Stay tuned. Have you ever wondered what Amsterdam is all about? Don't just read about the culture that has accepted cannabis. Experience it firsthand with CS Travel's Sensible Amsterdam Tour with Normal. Travel to one of Europe's most beautiful cities this January for an educational and recreational visit to a city that regulates cannabis like alcohol. CS Travel has arranged an exclusive visit for reform-minded Americans that includes a private tour of some of Amsterdam's most renowned coffee shops, educational seminars with coffee shop proprietors, local law enforcement, members of the Cannabis Retailers Association, and Normal staff. Entertainment includes a special evening at the Boom Chicago Comedy Club, canal tours, visits to the city's many museums, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. Don't just wonder about Amsterdam. Experience the beauty and freedom of this unique city firsthand with CS Travel and Normal Sensible Amsterdam Tour. Pricing information is available online at coffeeshoptravel.com. That's coffeeshoptravel.com. Or call toll-free at 800-816-1846. That's 800-816-1846. Be a sensible American. Visit Amsterdam with CS Travel and Normal this January. Call 1-800-816-1846 right now to book your trip. More information is available at normal.org.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves, and you're enjoying Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Please take a moment right now to support this organization by donating online.
Now, we didn't have to go too far back for this next Cannabis Science Archive segment, but it is quite apropos this week, the day after Christmas. This is our holiday stress segment. Mitch and I have been doing, did this last year as well, and it's a very popular segment. I always get some emails about it. This is from December 5th, just a few weeks ago. This week, we're doing our annual holiday stress segment. Thanksgiving just took place. Hanukkah has just begun. Christmas and New Year's are just weeks away. And this can all mean it's a pretty stressful time of year for some folks. What is it about the holidays that really ratchets up the stress?
You know, it's never any one thing, but I think a couple of things really contribute. First and foremost, unrealistic expectations. I'm concerned that people go out into the holidays and think, bells are going to ring, birds are going to sing, it's going to be the most delightful couple of days ever. And, of course, that really can set you up for a lot of disappointment. The other thing I see consistently among friends and clients is this over-planning where I look at what they're planning to do on, say, the 5 days around any of the holidays, and they're literally going to visit three different people at four different houses, and they're going to be driving seven different times and never going to get any sleep. And then, of course, you end up by the second day wishing that it were already January 3rd.
And is there a particular holiday, Mitch, that causes more stress than others?
There aren't tons of data comparing individual holidays, but at least among Americans and particularly Christians, Christmas gets a big spike in reported stress, and of all things, New Year's also gets one, and the fact that those are only a few days apart makes it a particularly tough time right in that week.
And for me, New Year's stress is like a week later, trying to lose those extra pounds and keep those resolutions. Is that part of the New Year's stress overall?
I think, and then in an effort to really stick to those new, often very restrictive rules they're setting up for themselves, it inspires people to really lose control and binge like crazy the few days before January 1st. So my birthday is December 30th, for example, and it has been traditionally a real big blowout. And so I have to think, well, in fact, if I'm not so constrained about what I'm going to do in the new year, maybe I don't have to feel like this is my last chance to go wild on these days beforehand, and then suddenly things become more moderate. The other big contributor, and I hate to say it, is just lack of sleep. And so people end up staying up really late, sleeping really late, and getting completely out of whack as far as their diurnal variation goes.
Also, Mitch, we all know that what we eat during the holiday season is usually less than healthy, and a series really of delicious indulgences. But does all that fat and other intense intake contribute to stress as well?
Not only the fat, but the sugar seems to be a big driver, and the caffeine. Sugar tends to, you know, send your blood sugar up very high, and then your pancreas is secreting all this insulin and ends up making too much, in fact, and then your blood sugar drops really, really low. You're suddenly hungry, irritable, craving, and then end up eating a sugary thing yet again and back on this roller coaster ride. It's funny how few holiday traditional foods have much protein in them. So whether you're eating latkes or grandma's fruitcake, you really need to make sure you get a couple of eggs or some nice lean meat in there as well, just to make sure you're actually getting your protein needs met. And it's astounding how sometimes just sitting down and having a slice of cheese and resting a little bit can have a wonderful impact on your mood, simply because you've had nothing but carbohydrates for day after day.
Now, also, you know, during the holiday season, many folks out there will end up drinking or smoking to excess at holiday parties or other events. Is that now an expected part of the American holiday season, that eating and intoxication to excess is kind of expected?
I think there's an automaticity to it. Like, it's like, oh, well, it's the holidays, I have to. And in fact, you don't have to. A couple of things to keep in mind. Alcohol slows THC metabolism. So odds are high, if you are going to have alcohol, you're not going to need anywhere near as much cannabis as you would need when you're not having it. And in fact, I feel like there's so many distractors, people don't really attend to how much they're consuming and their subjective state. So it's easy to notice after a single hit, oh, by the way, I want to wait 5 minutes before I decide if I have another one. And also, it's easy to turn around and go, holy cow, I'm on my fourth beer here, and I don't remember the previous three. And so if we're much more attentive as we go, and really enjoying the process, in fact, we end up consuming less. And often it's as simple as saying to somebody, wow, hey, this is a really interesting cannabis. I enjoy the heady effects, or this is a really somatic body high. Aren't you enjoying it too? And then suddenly you take a little pause to discuss the experience, and you end up consuming less and actually having a better time. Same with alcoholic beverages. Often, if you're going to splurge and have an interesting beer or a nice wine, I just had some things shipped from Australia I'm really looking forward to get. And you taste them and talk about them with your friends, and then you find, wow, it takes a little longer to get a whole glass down because I've actually been paying attention. And then your blood alcohol concentration is going to increase less rapidly, and you're much less likely to run into problems later on.
Also, Mitch, of course, not everyone is consuming to excess. Millions of families will gather for the holidays and consume some alcohol or consume some cannabis together as a family. But for the cannabis consumers out there heading to family functions, where maybe everyone doesn't smoke together, what would be good form to take here with the family? Could someone, you know, enjoying a nice holiday treat of some fine American marijuana make others in the family a little uncomfortable? What's the best way to approach that?
I think the key on here is this is a tough time for families anyway, regardless of psychoactive substances. And then anything that's going to alter the way you interpret information is invariably going to add a whole lot of extra variation into the mix. So I think the respectful thing to do is always let's take the folks who are interested in this into a separate area away from folks who really don't approve so that there doesn't have to be any conflict on this particular topic. But also, if anybody says anything that you think is hostile or they're throwing barbs at you or anything like that, this time of year, let's give everybody the benefit of the doubt. And so, you know, I happen to have an aunt who tends to say things that are, shall we say, not always the nicest. And often it's just a request to have somebody pay attention to her. And I realized, really, this time of year, everybody's either saying, I love you, or do you love me? And if you can translate everything everybody else says into one of those two things, then you'll know how to make it work. So somebody says something like, oh, you guys stepped outside and had to go outside with your very fancy thing. Then you come in and say, oh, we did. I love you. You know, instead of, let's turn this into the usual banter back and forth, and I'm going to have my tirade about legalization while you make up some insanity about Gateway or other misinformed arguments. Instead, this time of year, it's really, what are they saying? They're saying, do you guys love me? You just went outside without me, right? And then you say, yeah, I do love you, and off you go.
Righto. Well, it sounds like a really good approach there. Holiday stress is common. Even close-knit families will probably end up dealing with it as well.
Again, it's those expectations I mentioned before. I feel like people think this is the time of year when everybody should be, you know, holding hands and singing Kumbaya. And if you've been, you know, to 11 parties already and you just don't feel like that, there ought to be some room to get cut some slack on this. And if we can, again, do the same and cut slack to others, it'll go a whole lot better.
Well, Mitch, for me, the only thing that really stresses me out in the holidays is something that only came into play when we became parents, and that's this parade of gifts from the family to our daughter. So let me ask you, Mitch, for myself, my wife, and all of the parents out there, how do you really engage the grandparents and the family and say, you know, I love you, happy holidays, please do not bring over any more plush animals?
It's an interesting boundary, and I particularly with grandparents say, look, I know that being a grandparent has certain built-in expectations. What I was hoping to do was have the girls learn that things aren't all that matter. And what I was going to encourage you to do is, would you have an experience with my kids? Would you guys cook something together? Would you go work at the soup kitchen together? Would you put a puzzle together? Something like that, where it's time interacting and actually an experience rather than a thing. And at least I would say of the grandparents in my circle, 3/4 of them are willing to consider that as an opportunity. And I found that the magnitude of the gifts, if you will, the expensive gifts have decreased, and they're much more interactive things that they can then do with the child. And I feel like that's what I want to do, is enhance that relationship, not turn my children into a bunch of consumers.
Mitch, you mentioned going to the soup kitchen or volunteering. Not only does that contribute to our communities, volunteering is a great thing for us all to do all year. But can making that kind of volunteer effort also help combat stress?
It's astounding, because the actual physiological changes that accompany helping others are really documented, and my wife does some of that research on, you know, heart rate and blood pressure and things like that. But often, even the littlest kids can really get involved. So there's a place near us where literally they just have to pack these boxes and, you know, put toothpaste and toothbrushes and stuff like that in these little boxes to hand out. And even my 3-year-old daughter can toss a toothpaste box into another box, and so suddenly you've got this. And on the drive home, you really do feel like you've done something good. Like, at the end of the day, you can lay your head on the pillow and go, this was a day where I really, really helped. And there's just no substitute for that. And there's certainly not going to create that kind of feeling from, oh, look, I got the new trendy toy, even though it was $100 or something.
And folks can really go local with their volunteer efforts.
If you're into the local hunger groups, the soup kitchens in your own area, I feel like that may be a much easier way to go than trying to get a big national one. And the bottom line often is it doesn't have to be anything that elaborate. If you've got a friend who's just alone these holidays and you say, hey, we're coming over just to say hi, it's funny how even that can do the trick. And often those are the folks who, it's not that they're really bad off or they need charity or something like that, but that this can be a really lonesome time of year, and just a 15-minute drive-by visit can often make the big, big difference.
You know, in my life, many holiday evenings have been spent with great friends, great marijuana, but in talking about holiday stress and spending time with family, can we treat some of that stress with marijuana?
I've seen it work with a subset of folks, and obviously there aren't a ton of data on this, but particularly if you say, okay, I'm not going to use when I'm around people who I know it's going to be a problem for, or when I'm around people who where it actually isn't going to be a fun buzz for me, and then I'm going to look forward to it. So we're going to actually going to go home an hour and a half earlier than I would normally go home, and I'm going to have this be my reward for not having conflict, for driving sober, for making sure everything's going to go well. And then suddenly you got this thing to look forward to, so that even while you're in the midst of all the hubbub and the carving and the eating and everything like that, you can say, okay, but no matter how bad it gets, I've got my vaporizer waiting for me at home. And I think a lot of folks find a little comfort in that.
So that's the gift that cannabis consumers can give themselves this holiday season.
And I think we should all consider it.
That was our holiday stress segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine here in our Cannabis Science Archive. We're going to keep going.
Hey, is it 420 yet? This is Rick Cusick from High Times Magazine, and you're tuned into Normal's Audio Stash.
Our final segment today is from June 28th, 2007. Mitch is helping us cover some amazing medical news that came out this year, showing that smoked marijuana in particular was very effective for HIV-associated neuropathic pain. So it's a big study in many ways, and as you'll hear, find out just why it's important. That's why Normal's Daily Audio Stash, that's why this program has really been a fascinating project for me. Mitch is one of the many voices we bring on, but Mitch is really committed to the program, and that he interviews with us every single week on our one-year anniversary. He's like, you know, I talk to you more than I talk to some of my family, because we do. Every Wednesday, Mitch spends time to interview with us for the segment each week. And to bring you this kind of expert coverage, doesn't happen everywhere, folks, this coverage of marijuana. It's brought to you by Normal, a group that for over 30 years, has worked to legalize marijuana. And while it has remained prohibited, Normal has built up the expert database and the library of knowledge that is really necessary and is really working right now to make reform happen. So, you know, having Mitch on the program each week is sort of an audio representation of that. And in stories like this and this HIV neuropathy story in the studying of smoked marijuana, there's a lot of intricacies here. And that's why it's great to have an expert to really focus in on what's going on. This interview again took place on June 28th, 2007. To cover this topic further today, we're welcoming two of our regular medical experts to the program, Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who is professor of psychology at State University of New York, and Dr. John Morgan, who is professor emeritus of pharmacology at the City University of New York. Let's begin with Dr. Earlywine. Mitch, thanks for joining us here today to cover this important new research. Now, the study took a look at dronabinol, which is synthetic THC in a pill. Many know it as Marinol. The two are one and the same. The study looked at that oral THC along with smoked marijuana with HIV patients, showing this tremendous set of benefits. Now, Mitch, many Americans living with HIV and AIDS are already using medical cannabis. Is that right?
In fact, Dr. Fulton, the last author on this paper, has shown in the past that marijuana in folks who don't have any diseases increases caloric intake, and that was going to be the primary push for this. And, yeah, anybody who's been anywhere near a medical marijuana state knows that medical cannabis for HIV-related problems is something that at least we have tons of case studies supporting its efficacy. So,
now, Mitch, tell us about the process of this study.
This was actually a very bold and complicated study. Dr. Fulton has a lab where folks can actually be inpatient for a while. They have to hang out and stay there for a long stretch, and then that way you've got much better control over, you know, what other things people are doing while they're experiencing the effects of these various substances. Tons and tons of, you know, prohibitionists say, oh, we've got Marinol, we don't need smoked marijuana for medical uses. And so often they'll do tests where they compare the two, but if you're smoking marijuana, you know you're smoking marijuana, and you may expect things to be better from that. So in this design, they actually take a pill every day and smoke something every day, and then that way you don't know which thing is your actual source of your THC, so then any expectations you might have about one being better than the other are kind of blown out of the water, and then we don't have that argument about, oh, people think marijuana is better just because they think marijuana is better. It's not that it is.
And they also found that HIV patients who had smoked marijuana were also likely being prescribed doses of Marinol that were far too low to have any real effect on their condition.
It's hard, too, because it's orally administered. It takes such a long time for it to digest and have its actual impact. And so folks who I've talked to say they take a small dose, don't get anything, then they take a markedly larger dose, they don't feel anything for a while, then 3 hours later they're stoned to the bone and they can't really function the way they'd like to.
An interesting aspect of this study showed a very clear difference between Marinol and smoked marijuana when it came to sleep. The data shows that smoked marijuana had a marked positive difference in patients having better sleep patterns.
There was a study by Carlini years ago suggesting that THC and cannabidiol could both help insomniacs. What I like about this one, though, is it pointed out that only the high dose of cannabis, the close to 4% THC cannabis, was the one that had the significant impact on sleep. And it kind of lets us know that, hey, the idea that NIDA cannabis is going to do the trick for folks is perhaps faulty. If we had, you know, pharmaceutical-grade cannabis like they have in the Netherlands is 14% THC, people could use markedly less and get the impact they need on really important symptoms like food intake, nausea, and sleep disturbance.
Now, they did use the NIDA, the National Institute on... Now, they did use NIDA, or National Institute of Drug Abuse, supplied marijuana in this study. That's the marijuana grown at the University of Mississippi. Mitch, has NIDA ever offered any higher THC marijuana for research, or have they used sort of the same plant strain and same potency marijuana all these years?
I've heard rumors that you can get an 8% THC cannabis from them, but they won't send it to you pre-rolled, that it's too sticky, allegedly, for their rolling machine. I find that a little hard to believe, but I haven't seen published data on such a thing. This, you know, brings up Lyle Craker's issue, as we've discussed in the past, where if we could, you know, have another source of cannabis and really get a feel for other strains, I think it would be very, very important. If you go to a medical dispensary in California, you'll see they'll have strains that are, you know, particularly focused on each of these individual symptoms, and we just, you know, there's no way we're going to find out what's most efficient and most effective for these kinds of things until we can get those data.
Mitch, there was also a big difference between dronabinol or Marinol and smoked marijuana when it came to the patient's general mood. Early in the paper, the authors report patients complaining of overall mental cloudiness with the Marinol, but not with the smoked marijuana as such.
The beauty of any kind of inhaled vapor is that you pretty much can tell what the impact's going to be within a few seconds. If you've, you know, swallowed a pill and have to wait for it to digest for a few hours, you have no idea how high you're going to go, and that can be disturbing in its own way. I, you know, do always recommend start with a small dose and move up from there, because the opportunity to titrate with the vapor gives you the chance to really, you know, just alleviate symptoms and not have many psychoactive effects at all. So medical users, again, in California, where I was more familiar with them, have said that they can basically use cannabis to alleviate symptoms and not feel any intoxicating effects. And, in fact, in these data, we saw very little cognitive impairment, but, you know, some pleasant ratings of high and mellow and things like that. I, you know, can hardly say, hey, it would be sad for an AIDS patient to experience a little more mellowness and perhaps a little subjective friendliness and fun.
Indeed. And Mitch, I found it very interesting to read in this study exactly how the patients smoked the marijuana for the study. I wonder if you could touch on that.
Well, we've always been concerned about what they call smoking topography. How is it that we can make it so everybody gets a comparable dose, given that everybody smokes a little differently? Experienced users of cannabis are actually very efficient at knowing how big a hit they can take and how long they can hold it. Inexperienced users, often the reason they don't show any effects on the first time they use is because they take too big a hit and cough it all out, or they don't take a big enough hit. And so in this situation, they've really tried to time things so that your inhalation is part of a timed thing where you hear something, you're supposed to take a draw, and as soon as you hear something else, you stop, and then you exhale after a certain duration. And as you can imagine, this is a little artificial and feels a little strange to people, but if you're told, you know, hold smoke for 10 seconds, then certainly we know that everybody's done it pretty much the same manner, and we can hope that the range of THC in the bloodstream then will become.
Also, authors note that neither the smoked marijuana or the Marinol had any effect on the intense regimen of pharmaceutical medication these HIV patients were taking every day as well.
You know, years ago there was a study on basically white blood cells in a petri dish, and if you gave them, you know, literally way too much THC for an individual cell, they did seem to have some impaired immune function. And so then people were jumping up and down saying that this would translate to humans and to human cannabis users, and it's just pleasant to see that, that's not the case at all.
Perhaps one of the most striking results of the study, and this took place in a very short time, is that these HIV patients who would usually be losing weight actually were taking in enough food and calories to put on some pounds here. That alone is a major result.
I think the key on this is it's easy to think, oh, well, it's just a couple of pounds in 16 days and things like that. But any time you're moving in that direction when you're HIV positive, it is astounding. And we have really horrifying data to show that once weight loss gets to a certain point, death is really imminent. So any time you can hold on to a couple of extra pounds and gain a couple, that could really translate into a longer life.
Mitch, I asked a question along this line when we were discussing Donald Abrams' HIV neuropathy study with smoked marijuana, but do you think that this data, along with Abrams and other research, could allow HIV and AIDS patients, no matter what state they live in, to perhaps gain some federal approval to use medical marijuana, again, even if they don't live in a state that allows medical marijuana access?
I can only hope, Chris. I think these data will particularly help dispute the argument that we've got dronabinol and that's fine, because clearly dronabinol is not having the impact anywhere near as dramatically as the inhaled cannabis. I liked reading this article in part because I've read articles by Dr. Fulton's crew from the early 90s that were markedly less political, and I've been intrigued by this change in attitude and presentation over the years of the stuff that's coming out of this lab, as if they're finally saying, hey, everybody pay attention to us, this is very serious now, and we've tried being objective and nice and scientific in our language, and now we need to jump up and down and say, let's get this medicine available because people are dying.
Mitch, the authors did mention the political atmosphere for medical marijuana a few times in the paper. It's definitely rare for that type of language to enter into a medical research paper. How did you feel about that when you were reading it?
In truth, I always thought the letter of the research is the way to go and just present the data and let everybody interpret from there. But that hasn't been doing the trick. And now I'm finding more and more cannabis researchers in their discussion sections in particular say, now the implications for this are we need to help the sickest of the sick, so let's go do it. And at first I was worried about that, but now I'm kind of delighted because it's clear that there's no other way to get this to have the effect we want it to have. If you want to wake up and do research that's going to matter, that's a great way to spend your life. But then when people keep ignoring it, no matter what you publish, you have to up the ante, if you will, and point out that the attitudes need to change. And I was happy to see them stick to the data, but then elaborate on these implications, because clearly we're not getting the reaction to this kind of research that we want to see.
Mitch, at the top of the interview, we discussed how common it already is for those living with HIV and AIDS to use medical marijuana. Is there some hope that with all this recent research that patients might feel at least more comfortable discussing marijuana and their marijuana use with their doctors and nurses. I know many of them are just afraid to mention it.
You know, 14 million Americans used marijuana last month. I mean, we all need to come out and go ahead and do this. And it's funny, I was at the doctor recently and had one of those little forms to fill out, and they asked what drugs you use, and I wrote down cannabis because I feel like we all have to kind of come out in this way, and then suddenly things will get normalized a lot more. And particularly for the sickest of the sick, nobody should be surprised if somebody with cancer-related, you know, chemotherapy experiences or HIV is using cannabis. And the idea that we don't talk about it is kind of a shame. I've taken steps in Los Angeles, and I'm trying to take some steps here in Albany to say, let's make sure our physicians are trained on this as well. And so sending articles like this around to people to let them know that this is a really an important treatment, and it's not going to interfere with the other treatments for this disorder is a really great stat.
And Mitch, I have to ask here, is there real confidentiality when it comes to this issue in health professionals, especially when it comes to doctors and nurses working with HIV and AIDS patients, that if they mention that they use marijuana, will that be kept in confidence?
The HIPAA forms that you'll also sign will suggest that it's extremely unlikely that your medical forms would be accessible to other folks. And again, you know, I'm pretty out as cannabis users go, but I think as more and more people do it, it'll become more and more normalized, and then suddenly the stigma will disappear. But somebody has to take the first step, and so, of course, a whole bunch of us have, and, you know, we'll pay the price. I figure, you know, if I'm not getting people knocking down my door, perhaps it's okay for other folks to do the same.
Oh, Mitch, I really appreciate you taking time to join us here today to discuss this very important new research. Thank you again for taking time today.
Oh, always a pleasure, Chris.
Thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. We have links to it on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. We're continuing our coverage of this important new study showing that smoked marijuana and oral THC have tremendous positive benefits for HIV patients. Dr. Mitch Earlywine on June 28th, 2007. And that rounds out our Cannabis Science Archive here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Have some more best of shows for you this holiday week and next week. Brand new episodes. Looking back at 2007, a big year for reform. Really was a lot to look at this year. And we'll have over a dozen experts here on the program to go over the top 10 stories for marijuana reform next week, right here on the program. Thanks for tuning in today. See you tomorrow, 4:20.
You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.
Almost busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there. And we'd come to play, and not just for the ride.